So I'm really coming back home to myself in terms of being fundamentally a being who cares deeply about nature and other species and the wholeness of life.
Well, we were avoiding a rabbit hole a while ago called success, but I think you pretty much defined what your level is. Getting arrested! My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools and tips how to live life full of meaning, passion and purpose. So welcome to the program. My interview today is with Zoe Cohen, and she is a management consultant and executive coach. Zoe had the traditional success model education and career, and was accepted into Oxford University to study human sciences, and that led on her into the health profession. Her working career started in the health service in the UK, and she became the youngest board member of a health trust, that is the management structure of UK hospitals. She went on to serve at board level in various companies for over 9 years. In 2009, she left the health service to start a management and coaching consultancy, and she's been in that industry for over 10 years. I invited Zoe onto the show because she's had a significant change of mindset and shifted her focus. Zoe is now an active member of Extinction Rebellion. While it was a shift of thinking, it was more of a return to her roots. As you would hear in the interview, her choice of university degree and the study of human sciences was one of those pivotal points. She could just as easily have been happy studying ecology, and she may have followed a different career path. The big shift for Zoe came with a family crisis and the issuing of the IPCC report last November. There was this growing realization that what we're doing to the planet is unsustainable, and not enough was happening fast enough. I wanted to explore Zoe's transition, because professional people like Zoe are changing their view on activism. They're standing up for what they see as wrong and demanding action, even if that means coming into conflict with the state. As I said, Zoe was a management consultant and coach. She's now actively involved in Extinction Rebellion. In fact, she was arrested in London during the recent protests. Our conversation flows and is funny and sad and dark and hopeful. But see, I recognise that this podcast may be awkward for some people to hear, so I apologise in advance. Zoe passionately believes that humanity is on a trajectory towards extinction unless we do something. And that something must be big and it must be quick, because for her, time is running out. For me, there is more to this conversation than climate change. If you followed this podcast for any length of time, you would know my story and how I struggled over the last few years with my relationship with consumption-based businesses and the world of marketing. I stepped back from mainstream marketing some 15 years ago, and I square that by choosing to work with companies or people that are making a difference in the world. For me, our current level of consumption is pushing this planet to the edge. And what's become increasingly clear is we have to start making positive changes in lifestyle. There's just not enough stuff to keep this up. And we're also sinking in the stuff that we are making. To put this into perspective and give you an example, there is a company in Scotland that manufactures polyethylene. It's called INEOS, and it's a plant called in Grangemouth. Now, polyethylene is the primary material for plastic bags. This one plant produces 1,000 kilograms of polyethylene every minute. That's over 1,440 tons of plastic every day for making of plastic bags. And they're planning to put a second plant next to this one. Now, when you think of plastic bags, how many of them get recycled? How many of them end up buried in the ground? How many of them end up in the sea, killing fish, getting into the food chain? You know, plastic is becoming the problem of our age. This is just one material, one item. How many plastic things are there around you at this moment? Where will they go when you finish with them? Toothbrushes, pens, mobile phone cases, bags, suitcases, presentation cases. I mean, the list just goes on. Where does it all go? And that is the question I've been asking for quite some time. There are options, of course. It is possible to recycle this material, but we do not have the structures in place. There is a thing called the circular economy, but it won't happen unless we are determined to make it happen. Zoe is one of many people leading the charge and demanding that our politicians start to face these difficult issues, because business as usual is not going to cut it anymore. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Zoe Cohen. This podcast is long because we got into a big conversation, so it has been split into two. This is part one, and part two will be out in a few days. Welcome to Life, Passion and Business. I am delighted today to be with Zoe Cohen, who is an executive coach. But actual fact, she's a great deal more than that. Now, I met Zoe through LinkedIn because she's a prolific poster of all sorts of things environmental. And it very much appeals to my sense of the world. And I quite happily there replying to her comments and fighting some of the trolls, which is all good fun. So Zoe, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Paul. And thank you for your help with troll fighting.
Yeah, it's good fun, isn't it? So look, as I said, I met you on LinkedIn, and that's how I reached out to you. So that was why we're having this conversation today. And the reason I reached out to you really, because Life, Passion and Business is about people exploring their life and exploring what's important to them through the work that they do. I think that's probably the best way to can it, really. And I noticed that you are very much now in an environmental conversation, and I don't think you started there. So I'm really curious as what the journey's been for you.
That's a really good question. Actually, I'm just going to speak from whatever kind of is evoked in me by your question, Paul, because I'd rather be in the moment than overthought about it. And actually, when you said about the journey and your observations of my case, actually, I'm coming back home metaphorically. So I'm coming back to myself, really. That's the truth of it. Mm-hmm. So one of the articles I've put on LinkedIn a few months back now, as part of what I've called my kind of professional coming out process, one of the photos I put on as a sort of mass photo on the article was me at age 3 or 4 or something amongst a meadow of flowers. So I'm really coming back home to myself in terms of being fundamentally a being who cares deeply about nature and other species and the wholeness of life. And I think, I don't know if it's common for any people who are listening to this, but I don't think I'm the only one who we have that connection in our childhood, and then we get into the adult world and lose our way, and then we have to find it again. So I think there's a bit of that. I don't know how much longer you want to answer.
So what was the journey to executive coaching?
Because obviously, what was the journey?
Zoe obviously went through education and came out and got a job somewhere. So what was that story?
What was that story? It depends if you want the PhD version or the first degree version.
I want the version that gives the real story of Zoe.
The real story, okay. There's many depths and layers of real story. Okay, I will give you the real story. It's just a question of how much detail. If I go into too much detail, just stop me, Paul, okay?
Give us the fast jet thing then. So you left education with a view to becoming what?
It wasn't that simple, I don't think, sweetheart. Well, and I didn't I'm not sure I ever left education because I'm still learning. I've got three master's degrees and a postgrad, so I've never... I only left formal
education. You're a learner then, okay.
Yeah, I love learning. I've my last formal education, like in terms of qualifications, I only really finished about 5 years ago, and I just did another accreditation. So actually, I just like learning and like expanding my brain and challenging my brain. But coming back to your question, how did I get to be executive coach? So the sort of summary version is that I, when I was kind of in sixth form at school, and sixth form, my actual direction of travel was to go and do ecology or environmental biology at university. So that was what was on 4 out of 5 of my Booker form spaces. Remember back to the old Booker form situation? And so that was where my heart was. And then through a complete chaos theory thing, literally chaos theory, on a one day that I was off poorly from school, because I was the sort of person who wasn't allowed to be off from school. My mum would just package us off, you know, whatever. So the literal one day I was off in the whole of sixth form, I think, if not more than that. Some guy from Oxford Uni came to, one particular college, Oxford Uni, came to speak at our school, and particularly plugged this degree called Human Sciences. And so I was there because I was off sick on this one extraordinary day off sick. And when I got to school back the next day, my friends and teachers, or, you know, several of them, said, "You really need to look at this area, it's right up your street." And thrust a leaflet into my hand, a little A5 brochure, I can remember it now. It was a really interesting multidisciplinary biological, anthropological sciences degree covering a really wide range of topics, from genetics to demography, from animal behaviour to psychology, from epidemiology to...
Lots of ologies,
and a real breadth of science and social science, and, you know, and I have a brain that really likes breadth. I like depth, but I also like breadth, which is a bit of a challenge doing both. But I'm quite a big picture person, and so I saw this and I thought, this is really interesting. So I looked up nationally that there were a couple of other places that did a degree called the same thing, but nowhere did anything that looked quite as good or as interesting to me personally. So Oxford, I put it at the top of my Ochre form because they won't look at you unless you do, or that sort of snotty, ridiculous sort of system. And damn me, I got in. So, you know, it's like, so I go into that detail because actually I think our lives are a series of choice points or forks in the road, aren't they? So that was a fork in the road where actually, you know, I fully intended to go and do ecology or environmental biology, and, you know, maybe I would have been an extra Jonathan Porritt or something or whatever, you know, but actually, that's not where I went. I went in the direction of human sciences, which took me in a different direction, doing a different degree, being fundamentally more focused on the human side of things as opposed to the environmental and ecological side of things.
So where did that lead you? Well, I mean, obviously you came out with a degree at the end of that. Where did that lead you?
Yeah, so it took, I guess it did appeal to and connect with other passions that I had around public health and health inequalities. So it took me into the NHS. Okay. So I guess I'd always had an interest in health and health inequalities. So not hospitals as such, but, you know, the fact that enormous health inequalities globally, nationally, things like the inverse care law, for anyone who might know about these things, happy to explain more. But inequalities, really, I guess there's a sort of social justice and political piece in there as well. So that that took me, a sort of appealed to that, those parts of me, and took me in that direction. So I, in the whole milk round situation, I applied for what was then called the general manager.
For our American friends, the milk round situation is where companies come into universities looking for graduates, isn't it?
It's the whole process. Yeah, it's the process of in your final year applying for graduate jobs, either through companies coming round or the schemes that get promoted. Yeah, it's that whole process.
So you probably were in the last group of people that actually had this really proactive process of people coming to universities to look for people. Because the modern thing about universities now is you just, you know, they show you the door. Ta-da, thanks for coming.
Yeah, well,
jobs, yes, for the, for the jobs. Oh, yes. Oh, well, good luck.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's an interesting point, actually, Paul, because being at Oxford, albeit at one of the less famous colleges, was at St Anne's, which was much more normal, well, relative for Oxford. But anyway, the milkman did obviously consist, as far as I'm aware, of you know, banks and consultancies and accountancy firms and whatever, coming round to talk to people. But I didn't engage in any of that because I wasn't interested in the standard capitalist corporate model. It didn't interest me. So,
you've always been an activist then?
Well, at heart, yeah. I've got the gene for it, definitely. And I mean, I was leafleting for the Green Party at age about 13. So it's part of my DNA. Environment and social justice and, you know, lots of things. So I didn't do any of the normal milk rounds, and actually the NHS Graduate Management Training Scheme, which is what I ended up on, they didn't come to, I don't think they came to Oxford. If they did, I don't remember. I just basically wanted a graduate scheme. I had a kind of itch to do something managerial, leadership-y. Not sure I knew what leadership was in those days, but, you know, the NHS appealed to me, had interest in health inequalities, etc. It was a big scheme. So I think it was pretty much the only thing I applied for. So thank goodness I got on it, because it was very competitive. So it was a good job.
So you ended up in the health service.
I ended up in the health service, I did end up in the health service and ended up 15 years in the NHS.
Wow.
15 years in the NHS.
Now our audience here, a large percentage of our audience is American. So the health service is kind of an anathema. It's kind of like this crown thing that we have, you know, and it depends on who you talk to, which side of the fence you're on in that viewpoint, whether it's a good thing or not. So what was it like living and working in the health service? Is it a very structured environment? Is it a very autocratic environment? What's it like?
There isn't a single answer to that, Paul. And yes, an extra big hi to our US colleagues and friends listening. Thank goodness for the NHS. It's an incredible institution, and I'm incredibly proud to have had anything to do with it. At the same time, goodness me, it's a diverse and challenging entity to work in. I can't give you an straight answer to your question, because it changed enormously. You know, when I started working in it, this is going to show my age, I started working in it in 1991.
Okay.
And, you know, so before mobile phones, before internet, yeah, etc. So, you know, mind you, it wasn't just the NHS that was in that state, it was most of the world, wasn't it? You know, we're still paper memos and all of that sort of old fashioned stuff. And culturally,
patient notes, big stacks.
Yeah, well, there's still a fair bit of that around the place, I think. So it was a very, very different world. And I had mixed experiences on the training scheme of, you know, and as I think many of us do, learn a lot, if not learn most, from the worst practices we observe or are subject to. So, you know, the poor leaders and managers that we have, and the occasional really good ones. I soaked up all the experience. I've had really mixed experiences, some great, lots of not so great, you know, learnt a lot in the process. Through twists and turns of fate, bit of chaos theory and a lot of hard work, I became one of the youngest exec directors in the NHS. I think I was 27.
Wow, that is young for an exec director. Where were you based?
I started off in the Northwest, and then through the twists and turns of life, ended up in Surrey.
Okay.
So I became the director in a mental health and learning disability provider organisation, or trust, as they were called then. Just translating the jargon, I think it was 1998. Anyway, it doesn't really matter what the dates are, but anyway, I 95, I think I started there, became a director by the time I was 27, which was
That's quite a role to hold, or a director. Is that a financial position as well, or is it resource management?
My role, that particular role, was leading, responsible for a lot of the corporate functions apart from finance and facilities. So, you know, all the rest of it, really, from HR, training, IT,
so
innovation, development,
if your passion all those years ago was playing within the garden with flowers, where did your passion go when you were an exec director in the NHS?
That's a great question, Paul.
I'm known for them.
Yeah, that's great. Be a coach. So where did it go? I don't think it didn't go altogether, that's for sure. So if I think of it, you know, think of it laterally, because that's how my brain works. I, whenever I could, which wasn't as often as I like, because I work very long hours, I, you know, got outside, walking or cycling, being outside, growing stuff in the little back garden yard thing that we had in the house that we were renting, and then the house we managed to buy down there, doing lots for the garden and trying to grow stuff, and just being outside at any opportunity, really, and connecting with the outdoors, and that never went away. To this day, very much, if weather is lovely, and especially in the spring and the summer, I literally cannot stand being inside. It's almost physically painful. I just want to be outside. What else happened? I suppose I still, so that never went away. And the kind of parts of me that care about, you know, social justice and care about doing the right thing for people who are in difficult situations or society often doesn't pay attention to. So, you know, people with mental health problems, and particularly people with learning disabilities, and that first organisation where I was a director.
Yes, so obviously working in NHS, particularly in mental health, and that has never been funded well. So I imagine you were probably at the core of that one.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I've not been, you know, I'm not clinical. I wasn't a nurse or a doctor or a therapist or anything like that. But I don't think it doesn't in any way preclude non-clinical people from caring and being motivated by purpose and values to work in the service.
I mean, so, around that sort of time, I was dating a psychiatric nurse in London.
What a coincidence.
And she was working at an old institution called Free and Barnet. Free and Barnet was the largest lunatic asylum in London.
Well, we really have and got parallels in our lives.
Built as a lunatic asylum. And on the old maps, it says lunatic asylum.
Yes.
And I went into that place, and this was supposed to be a place to try and help people get better. And it was horrendously long corridors, dark, long corridors.
I mean,
at that time, mental health was not a nice place to be involved with.
No, and it's interesting. We've got a lot of parallel kind of experiences and connections there. And you've also just reminded me of something, of another bit of story that connects me to not away from the garden and the flowers that you've highlighted, but another kind of connection along the sort of social justice and et cetera kind of piece I was brought up by parents who had some strong values, which is wonderful, and was a wonderful person. And when I was, how old was I? From about 11, my mum worked as a full-time fundraiser, paid next to nothing, but nonetheless paid, for a local organisation that was called, it was a local cerebral palsy charity. It wasn't called that. Used for the terminology in those days that aren't appropriate now, but it was a local cerebral palsy charity. So from a fairly young age, I was kind of surrounded by, and my mum had always done community and voluntary stuff, and I just had it, you know, I was brought up that that's what you do, and I think that's a great way to be brought up that that's what you do. So I helped with all sorts of fundraising, working in charity shops, helping disabled young people with cerebral palsy round trips when people took them out. I just helped at stuff. So I guess that gave me an exposure at quite a young age to people with serious learning disabilities and physical disabilities. As you say, in those institutions, going back to what you made about those institutions, and they were called bins, weren't they? That's one of the names they were given. They were called bins because that's what people were put.
But people were put, people got rid of in those places. I mean, some of the people that Tracy knew at the time there were put there for having illegitimate children.
Absolutely.
They weren't there because they were mad. They were there because the family got rid of them. So
exactly. And that pokes at my feminist button. Another strand of it, the sort of social justice and ethics and values is very feminist.
We could go down a rabbit hole here, and I think we perhaps better avoid it. So moving forward in your life, you've obviously got some success in terms of being this director, but that's a success. Is where did it go from there?
Okay. Yeah, I will resist the rabbit hole of all, and there's another rabbit hole that we could go down in the definition of success, Paul. I mean, what is success?
You're preempting a question.
So let's
get the whole story out as how we got to here. Then we can unpick what success means.
So became a director very, very young, learned loads, got very stressed, practically burnt out, but not quite. Learned loads, very, very formative experiences in that first director role, but wouldn't want to go through that again in that particular situation, the learning curve that I needed to go on and the kind of lack of support that I had, really. Mm-hmm. So where did I go from there? Well, a few things happened. Whilst I was in that first director role, my dad died. He died when I was 28, so that was pretty young to lose your dad nowadays. And that knocked me for six, as you probably expect. One thing that my dad, bless him, used to say, one of his expressions, which is Talmudical, I think, because he was Jewish and I was brought up Jewish, was that there's no pockets in a shroud. Mm. It's the more sort of regular Anglo-Saxon expression, might be, you can't take it with you.
Yeah.
So, when Dad died, I kind of that together with the kind of sense of, okay, I can do this job, but I am working off the scale and just looking ashen and looking like a shell of myself because I was working so hard. Not necessarily smart, but very, very, very hard. So I did it, and then I thought, right, okay, I want to change here. I'm just going to do something else. And the else that I was interested in doing was having a different kind of impact at a national level.
Okay.
So I jumped out of the NHS for a bit of a change. I went to work at what was called the Audit Commission.
Okay.
The Conservatives got rid of the institution because they didn't like the fact that it highlighted inequalities in investment and all sorts of things and quality of public service and things. But I went to work there, specifically running what we call value for money projects, so like kind of research projects that investigated the efficiency and effectiveness and distribution and fairness and all the rest of it of public services, and published high profile reports to highlight improvements that need to be made.
I can see how government would find that a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, but I can't remember the history, but it was government fundamentally created the organisation many years before that, but obviously in different times and with different flavours.
Well, it was about measurement of efficiency of government at the time, but of course when policy is walking in the other direction, these things become a little bit too
inconvenient.
Inconvenient
truth. It was in its day a really good organisation that did a lot of really great work and published reports that did highlight things that needed to change across public services. So I'd always known of the organisation kind of growing up in my career, and I'd seen these kind of reports and things that got produced in national service.
Were you managing it or were you writing reports? What was the role you took?
Both, Paul, because it's not a very big organisation and I was recruited specifically, or I applied specifically, to lead a project on looking at a research project looking at education and training across the NHS.
Right.
Across NHS Trust. So obviously that was my background. Right. I was really interested in education and training, and that was part of what I led on. And as I mentioned before, I'm learning obsessed. I love learning and development generally. It was a sort of sweet spot of the topic, the area, the sector, and the kind of work I wanted to do. So when I saw that come up, I thought, yeah, that job is just made for me. I need to do that. That's what I should do.
So that obviously worked with your passions in that respect, that job.
Yeah, and yes, and actually, you know, I don't think I've ever done a job that didn't go with my passions, to be honest, because whilst I'm a pretty rational, analytical person, I'm also pretty passionate, you know, right and left brain. So I put a lot of myself into what I do, and I can't do that without being passionate about it.
So jumping on, you must have left that one to be, so at some point you became an executive coach to give you
So I worked at the Audit Commission for about 3.5 years, learnt lots, did another project on children with special educational needs, which was really interesting. That was down in, so I was down in the southeast, relocated back up to the northwest to be nearer my mum, who since died, bless her, and to start a family and all of that kind of life stuff that happens. Went back into the NHS because I missed it, and I missed being a director and sort of shaping cultures and shaping parts of organisations and stuff. So I did a couple more director jobs and then got to the stage where, I guess, answering your question, how did I get from there to be an exec coach? Well, I think two or three things happened. I think it was, well, lots of things happened, but one being my kind of interest and passion in growing and developing people, spotting talent, having an antennae for talent, wanting to, you know, unleash people's possibilities and potential, that kind of stuff. That kind of grew and grew and grew, and tipped the balance with my passion for kind of running stuff or organising stuff in the NHS, which I think was probably helped to be tipped by the fact that I think by that time I was about to go into the at least fifth or sixth lot of national reorganisations in the NHS in the 15 years that I've been in it. And, you know, there's only so many times you can bend a twig till the twig snaps, and my twig just couldn't be bothered anymore, I think. I'll try not to swear. So, and also the particular reforms that, you know, I know US colleagues won't connect with these necessarily, but the particular reforms that were happening back in 2008, 2009, 2010 were reforms that I just couldn't buy into. Before then, I could sort of buy into the reforms more or less, but it's not that I couldn't buy into them. I didn't agree with the direction of travel. And at the same time, my passion for developing, growing people had been growing. I'd started coaching, gone part-time a little bit, and started my coaching development journey, and also had my daughter. So all of that combined with, you know, wanting to try and reduce my hours and also have a more flexible life where I could actually be a better mum and spend more time with my daughter, which was very conflicting to not be able to do that, because I'm not good at putting any less than 100% of myself into anything. So all of those things came together in kind of 2008, 2009, and I, at the end of, well, just before the end of 2009, I left to become a coach full-time.
Wow. And so that now you have a full-time coaching practice?
I started my practice formally in April 2009, and so I celebrated my decade in practice a couple of months ago, which I guess a few months ago or a year ago I would have, you know, thought I would be proud of being 10 years in practice, you know, running a successful practice that's grown over time and not grown in the sense of employing others, because I'm not interested in that, but grown in terms of reputation, experience and size for me personally. So I've been done a lot of good work with a lot of really lovely people across lots of sectors. And whilst I do feel proud of some of that, I don't feel as proud to be a coach as I did. Also that actually since sort of back end of last year, beginning of this year, New Year time, I'm actually spending less and less time coaching and more time on climate activism.
Which is, yes, how I met you.
Yes, how we kind of bumped into each other in the LinkedIn sphere. That's right. So I still coach, and obviously I particularly enjoy bringing my coaching skills into serve people or clients or organisations that are on the same agenda and on the same path to try and make, you know, the urgent difference that we so desperately need to climate and ecology.
So what caused that shift? What made you jump out of executive coaching and then suddenly say, hang on, the planet's more important? Because one is they're both self-serving in a way, but one is like your immediate self and the other one is actually this is a much wider picture.
Yes. So I wouldn't say I've jumped out of executive coaching altogether because I've still got one foot in there, and I'm seeking to influence the coaching community broadly because I think it's a community that I can try to influence. So I've still got one foot in there, and I'm still working with some clients. But I would say 2/3 of my energy probably more than 2/3 of my energy is on the climate related stuff. And why did that happen and what happened? So again, as the way life happens is I think that we have moments or periods of time, don't we, where things collide or come together. So I guess I've been increased. Well, how far back to go on this story, Paul?
Don't go
So
too far back. Don't go too far back on it. But I'm just curious of what the junction was, because it's like coaching is your living, is how you make your money, but activism is not going to make you money. So
No.
and you've made a decision to change your life effectively for the bigger picture.
Yes, but then money's never been everything to me, because if it had been, when I was at Oxford, I would have jumped on the milk round with the banks
No,
and
but
the
there's still some sacrifice in here.
yeah, maybe. But money's never been my biggest thing. It's I wasn't brought up with a lot of money, and I don't feel like I need tons of it. What was the sort of critical point? There's three or four critical things that happened, basically, I think, and they were kind of all connected. So I never disconnected from the importance of climate, etc. But I think, like some people, I put too much trust in the system, far too much trust in the system. Although part of me knew that probably wasn't right. But I guess, I got on with my life. I did other things. I did things like chairing a community energy company and getting investment into solar power for local schools and things like that, and put a lot of my personal voluntary energy into that for about 3 years. But knowing all the time that actually that was, even though it was good and it was more than most people do, it was just a tiny speck and it just wasn't enough. So I guess this growing frustration and knowledge that just isn't enough. And so I guess combining that with a continuing awareness of, just from my own experience, about the degradation of the natural world, the species loss and biodiversity loss, just from, going back to that picture of me in that meadow, we don't have places like that anymore. They just don't look like that anymore. Even verges by the road don't have the same biodiversity in them that they used to. The UK is one of the most nature depleted countries on the planet, amongst others. So that personal experiential process, the process of grieving for losing my mum, who was very poorly, and I was her carer for sort of 18 months plus. And that process of grieving for the planet and grieving for the mum I was losing at the same time, all combined really. And then two other specific things happened, kind of like at the end of last year, late last year. One was the IPCC report that came out in October. So you're probably familiar, and I hope that listeners are familiar that, the
Didn't the
Intergovernmental.
report come out Monday and Heathrow get accepted 5 days later or something?
I don't doubt it for a minute, Paul.
Something like a report came out on Monday and 4 days later the Parliament voted on whether to accept a third runway. And
I'm sure.
I'm going, you what?
Yeah, and those you what moments are continuing more or less daily, aren't they now?
They are a bit, yeah.
The IPCC report, the one that was trailed as, 12 years to save the world, came out in October. And prior to that, I recall when the Paris Agreement was signed, when the countries came together to sign the limit to 2 degrees. And I didn't know as much as I know now about the reality of climate change and climate science. I knew some, but I didn't. So I remember when the 2 degrees was signed, I remember crying when I heard the news, kind of crying with relief and joy that, thank God, they've agreed to do something. We may stave off the worst of this. And I put too much trust. I just, put too much trust in that. So two more things happened that late last year that kind of came together on this journey. One was the IPCC report being published, and it came out within a matter of few weeks really from my mum dying, so that was quite poignant as well. At this, shortly afterwards, I became aware. I began to become aware of Extinction Rebellion, which has been a big part of this for me. So, you know, this journey of one after my mum died, I knew before she died, because the process was long and horrible, but that when I emerged from it, I would be dedicating the rest of my life to making a difference, more than I had done. And so I knew that it was just a question of how could I do that? What could it be? How could I make the most difference? I'm a bit obsessed about impact and have to make an impact, otherwise I just can't deal with it, basically. So the IPCC report came out, and then I became aware of Extinction Rebellion via a tweet from a colleague. I didn't know about them. I became aware of the bridge blocking that they did in London in November. Thought it was absolutely brilliant. I think by Christmas I'd watched the YouTube video of Gail Bradbrook doing the Heading for Extinction talk. Mm-hmm. So if people listening haven't heard it or watched it, I totally, utterly recommend Googling Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It.
What's it called?
Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It.
Okay.
So if you just put that into Google, you'll get a few YouTube videos. And the original one from last May 2018, it's Dr. Gail Bradbrook, one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, doing the talk, one of the very first versions of the talk, which looks like she's in someone's front room, and that's because I think she is in someone's front room.
There is a fascinating talk about a guy, which I heard years ago, and the guy is talking about bacteria in a bottle.
Yes.
And it's this idea that the bacteria in the bottle doubles every 2 hours.
Until it kills itself.
And then what happens... But the point is, at the doubling point, it doesn't know that extinction is coming. It has no indication that it's reaching the edge of the bottle.
Yeah.
And then it reaches the edge of the bottle, and then it starts trying to double again, and there's no capacity. Suddenly, it's pushing against the limit.
And
it doesn't know the limit's coming.
It's not rocket science, Paul, is it? I remember learning about that as a kid. It was all so obvious and intuitive to me as a kid. You know, that the world is finite, and if we shit in it, then we end up eating our own shit. I mean, it's just like, actually, that's not a good example. Shit is actually good because you can make manure out of it. But, yes. You know, if we pollute it, there's nowhere else for it to go other than to the planet that we're in. And it was so obvious to me from such a young age. And, you know, my wonderful daughter, who's 16 and has just finished her GCSEs, which is a shocking thought, that she's old enough to realise this stuff. She was saying practically the same thing you just said to me, only in the matter of the last few weeks, that, you know, they do experiments where they look at yeast in a test tube and how long can it live for before it, you know, dies off because it's killed itself kind of stuff.
Alcohol in the test tube kills it, yeah.
Oh, these things are just so obvious when you actually do any science or think about it or engage with it at all. But anyway, coming back to, So I became aware of the roadblocking that Extinction Rebellion did in November. I thought it was utterly wonderful and inspirational, and cried. Then I watched Gail Bradbrook's talk. I think I watched it in the December, and cried some more. And made my husband watch it, and he eventually did, or he had to watch it in parts because he couldn't quite digest it all. And I told him that as a result of all the stuff I've already shared with yourself and obviously hundreds of other people, I don't know, but never mind, that's all good. I told him that now was the time for me to get arrested for this stuff, because there was no alternative, because we tried everything else and it now had to be the next step. He kind of went white and practically fell over, and started trying to convince me that, you know, to not do it, whatever, but I didn't obviously take any notice.
Did you get arrested?
Yes, I did in April. So I guess the journey from kind of November onwards has been understanding, becoming aware of Extinction Rebellion, finding out more about it, watching the Extinction talk. I went to my first local meeting in January, volunteered straight away to get involved. So I became one of the volunteers who gets trained up to deliver that talk, the Heading for Extinction talk. So I I and other people deliver that talk to hundreds and hundreds of people across the UK and beyond.
So what is the process around getting arrested? Because that's obviously you have been. I mean, is that a court case going on, or what's the next step for that?
Yeah, so I was one of the 1,100 odd people that were arrested in April in London as part of the International Rebellion. Many of us were first-time arrestees, so we hadn't been through it before. And the system, you know, basically there were so many of us, the system couldn't really deal with it at the time. And so, you know, we obviously did go through the whole process.
Now, I did watch it, and I thought your system was very, very clever, because you were passive in the being arrested. It took four policemen to arrest one person because you weren't moving. So they just ran out of resources. They just did not have the resources.
Yeah.
Because you didn't use any violence, they couldn't bring or justify bringing in heavy resources. They couldn't justify bringing in a riot squad because you guys weren't rioting.
No, that's the point. You know, that one of the absolute fundamental principles and tenets of XR, Extinction Rebellion, is it's completely peaceful, non-violent action.
Yeah.
And that's for two reasons. One, because it's the right thing to do. You know,
yes.
We want a better world. We have to be that better world, and peace and non-violence is the way to be. It's also a damn sight more effective. You know, all the evidence from the studies show that, funnily enough, violence and aggression and war doesn't achieve system change.
Two things push against each other, it just increases the polarity, and it allows for more pushing. When one side just gives, the energy of pushing runs away. It just dissipates.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we're giving, but we're sort of. Non-violent events.
Well, you're not adding an opposition to it, so there's no justification for escalation on the ground.
In an escalation sense, I agree. Many of us are waiting to hear from. To get asked, well, personally, I'll just personalise it. I'm waiting to get my magistrate's court summons if it comes. I saw an article in the press yesterday. I think one of the first people as part of the London process, who was arrested, another Extinction Rebellion colleague, was found guilty of roadblocking, etc. That was in the press yesterday. So. He was one of the first people to be actually convicted, because obviously various people have been charged and go through the process, and a load of us haven't been charged yet because we haven't been summoned yet. So, but you know that the system is utterly mad, Paul. You know that the system, because I get it. You know, I get it. But a system in which it's even hard to put into words. It's so mad. But you know, the current system, particularly if you go to a magistrate's court, or the legal system doesn't listen to a case, a defence of necessity. So necessity as, you know, the fact that we're peacefully blocking roads, etc., to highlight the utter existential threat that we're in, and the ecocide that's being committed all across the planet by, you know, corporations and governments and so on. And it's... the system is such that it can't and won't hear that, you know. So
the system wasn't designed for that. The system is designed to maintain business in the status quo. The system was only designed to keep the people in place.
Yeah.
It was designed by the elites to keep the business in place. I mean, and the legal system goes back centuries for that reason.
That's where things are at, really. So we, you know, myself and a whole big bunch of other people are waiting to see what the system's going to do.
Well, we were avoiding a rabbit hole a while ago called success, but I think you pretty much defined what your level is. Getting arrested! No! So if you've got this far on the podcast, you're obviously enjoying the conversation with Zoe, which is wonderful. So if you want to catch up with that, part two will be up in a few days. And the best way to keep up with that is to subscribe and follow, and you'll get notifications straight into your phone. Anyway, we'll catch you soon. All the best. And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Zoe Cohen.
You can find and connect with Zoe on LinkedIn, Facebook, and at her website, shinecoachingandconsultancy.co.uk. The details on the website are at Life, Passion and Business underneath the podcast player as usual. That is all for this week. Part 2 of this program will be out in a few days. In the meantime, please consider your position on this subject. It's not going to go away. As humans, we have to change or die. If you want to talk or explore views on this subject, please get in touch. For me, it's not a question of giving up, but it's about adaptation and adjustment. But to do that, we have to start talking and explore what is possible. So thanks for your time and attention, and I will catch you next time. Part 2 will be out soon. All the best.